Accession number 28645, rule 16.
And we didn't do the upper Nile up to Aswan until, wait a minute now. Yes, my mother and I did it then. That's right.
Well, tell me about that.
Well, that was fascinating. It started from Luxor, from the just above the dam.
What started?
The boat. It was a Cook's boat.
There was a dam there even at that time.
Yes, there was a dam at that time. And when the Nile flooded, there was one wonderful temple called the Temple of Philae, and it was in the big basin, which flooded when the Nile flooded and held the water back. The dam was at Luxor, just above Luxor. No, Aswan, the dam. And so this temple used to disappear at the flooding of the Nile, which was the only reason to go in the summer. So I never saw anything but the top of it. But my professor and his wife, they visited in this before there was a dam. No, I'm mistaken. There was a dam. And they visited during the time of the dam, that's right. And they took a boat out to the top of Philae, and there was a full moon, and they took a record with them, and they danced on the top of Philae, which I think is a lovely thought. But to return, yes, so then my mother and I went up for a prolonged stay in Luxor, and we took the boat to Aswan. And we saw Abu Simbel, of course, in its original place.
Original position.
We drew up there. It was a night of the full moon. We kept on. There seemed to be a lot of full moons in those days. But we seemed to hit them. It was the night of the full moon, and we anchored. And Abu Simbel had a lovely little beach in front of it. So you anchored, and then you went in a little rowing boat. Landed on the beach, and this wonderful temple standing there in the moonlight on its own beach, it was absolutely gorgeous. And so we explored it, and a very curious thing happened. I got to a certain pillar in the inside, and I found myself quite unable to go round it. Something held me back. It wasn't exactly physical, it wasn't exactly mental, it was just something that I couldn't go around the pillar. So I went back to my mother, who was a bit halfway down the temple, and I said, that pillar's interesting, do go and look round it. So off she went, she got as far as I got, and she said, darling, I can't go any farther. I can't go. So we left it, and we did the rest of the temple, and that was fine. We had a psychic on board. Good lady, she used to trail about in a long white gown in the evenings, and she was very psychic. So we sat down around the Ouija board, and we asked what was going on and why we couldn't go around the pillar. Oh, they said, we were there to prevent you, to protect you, because there was a cobra just round the corner. Very curious. But, oh, it did look gorgeous where it was. I've seen it since, and it's pathetic. Absolutely dreadful. That was one of the things I didn't like about that journey when I took my friend, because I had to see Abu Simbel dug out. Dreadful. Tragic. And then we went on up the Nile to Aswan, and of course, in those days, there were temples dotted all the way up the Nile. Every few miles, you'd come across another one, small temples. And we got to Aswan. Nass Farm was a bit dicey in those days. I mean, there were soldiers and you weren't allowed to photograph, and it was all very, very touchy. And all the shopkeepers, when they saw us come, they said, when are you coming back? When are you coming back? Of course, we never went back, the British. They'd already handed us one over. But that was a wonderful journey. It was absolutely marvellous. And just taking your own car and going off into the wilderness, and then seeing one of these gorgeous temples. We went to one, I remember, and we took a picnic with us. And there were lots of kites. And I had my piece of chicken in my hand like this. I was just going to take a bite out of it when it disappeared. You had to be very careful of your food, because otherwise the kites got it. It was a lovely time. Those journeys to Luxor were magical, and my mother got to know, she went up on her own afterwards and got to know Aboudi and his family very well, the wife and the children. And he had been asked several times by people who wanted to do his biography, and he wouldn't allow it. And then he asked my mother to do it, which she did.
He asked her to do it? And she wrote it when? At that time, roughly? Or
she wrote it where she made all the notes then. But she wrote a lot of it here, from the notes. And we sold some of it, but it's a matter of marketing.
You sold?
Oh, yes.
You sold what?
The book.
I see, yes.
The Egyptian Society duly advertised it, but we advertised it, but it just didn't catch on. We didn't have the power behind us to advertise, so I've got a lot of them left, and I'm going to give them to the Egyptian Society for their members, as I've had to give mine to Q. Do you know, they haven't even sent me a letter of thanks.
You've given some of your books to Q, have you?
Yes, I had some over. Had about 900 over, I suppose, of volume one, and oh, maybe more, maybe 1,000. I had 2,000 printed, and I think I sold about 800. 800 or 900. And the printing firm who did them, the person who'd owned it, sold it to the second in command, and the second in command was no commander, as I told you. He was a printer of great gifts, but as to running a business, he hadn't the first idea. So he ran it into the ground. It's gone bankrupt. They stored my books. They couldn't store them anymore. I hadn't room here, so they had to go somewhere. So I offered them to Q, and they were delighted to accept. Q sent them off, and I haven't had a word. Nobody said thank you very much. If they sell them at even roughly the price they were at, they'll make thousands of pounds. But I have not had a word. Q are like that. Not a bit polite. So.
Well, we'll come back to that, shall we, at another time?
Yes. I'm drifted on from Luxor.
Because we've moved away from Luxor slightly.
That's right, we have. So we had quite a lot to do with Luxor and Cairo while my mother was there, and we saw everything that there was to see. And it was all very interesting. We went up into the Mokattam Hills near Cairo, visited the Royal Mosque. I think we saw everything that man had to show us. He didn't show us the rubbish tips where the children go to get some food, which is quite a sight. We went to the pyramids, of course. Oh, yeah. No, that wasn't when we rode the camels. We didn't ride the camels that time. We rode them on our visit from these. Yes, we haven't done the cruise, have we?
The cruise?
Mm.
Which cruise is that?
The cruise was just after the Monte Carlo rally. Well, Monte Carlo, yes, round the houses as it was known then. And we cruised right round the Mediterranean. But that was later on. And that was another visit that we did, but it was a short visit to Cairo and the pyramids. It was only a cruise visit, and they're short. But it was a wonderful cruise. It was on a little ship called the Stella Polaris, and it only took about 50 people. And it did the whole of the Mediterranean. It did Ephesus and places like that, and Kos, and it did the islands, the Greek islands, and it did the coast of Turkey, Ephesus and Daphne, and a whole lot of places that nobody else goes to. I expect they go to them now, and they're probably overrun. They weren't overrun in those days. And then we called in at Jaffa for Jerusalem, and Jaffa for Damascus. Went to Jerusalem, did Egypt, we did the north of Africa. It was a very comprehensive cruise, quite extraordinary. Little Polaris, Stella Polaris she was called. She finished up on the Norwegian run, which was a bit of a contrast. What's happened to her since, I don't know. So, they were good days.
I want to take you on to...
So that was that period then, what we did then.
Because we've covered some of the Egyptian story before yesterday.
That's right.
I'd like to take you on to the outbreak of war, because you said you were in the period immediately before the outbreak of war, because off tape you said this afternoon that you and your mother went to Germany and Austria in August 39.
That's right.
Can you tell me something about that?
Yes. My mother had rented this little tiny villa built into the side of the mountain at Ravello. And it was next door to the headland, which had a very smart house on it. It belonged to an English lord, and I can't remember his name, not for the life of me. But he had the whole of the headland, and we nestled next door. And we had a good lady, Margarita, who used to come and do the cleaning. And she also did the cleaning for the big house, so we got all the gossip. And, well, there was a whole section of life that where we were at Ravello. But Greta Garbo came to stay.
With you?
No. Oh, gracious me, no, we were much too small. She stayed at the big house, she was invited. And it was the time when she was having an affair with Stokowski. And he came, so they were our neighbours. But Margarita came in one morning and she said, "I don't know," she said. "It's terrible. That poor lady, she must have a terrible deformation of her face. She goes about with a veil on all the time. And she said, if anybody appears, she hides in the bushes." It was the "I want to be alone" complex. But she carried it through even in these private gardens. Margarita was quite concerned about her. Prince Umberto used to come through with sheaves of girls in his open car, had an open tourer, and lots of pretty girls in the back and the front. He came quite often. Quite a lot of important people used to come to Ravello. And we were settled there at that time, before the war. I'd gone to stay with my mother from Egypt, because I left Egypt in summer. This was 39. went to stay with her, and as I say, we got our heads together one night and we said, if there's going to be a war, we're not going to see Germany and Austria again. That won't do. So my mother said, right, let us go and visit and say goodbye. So we went and visited and said goodbye, and that must have been about the first week of August. So we went right up through Italy, changed at Milan, crossed to Verona, up through Bolzano in Austria. My mother went on to Munich and I went on to Salzburg, where I caught the baby train to the White Horse Inn. Said goodbye to everybody. Very sad. And I saw, that's right, I stayed at the White Horse Inn, then I went on to Bardisal, which was a big hunting spot for the emperors of Austria. They used to go and hunt there. I went on to Bardisal, stayed with a friend, and I saw the son off to join up. He'd been called up. So it was as near as that. I said goodbye to him on the train. He had his calling up papers.
Okay, Suzanne.
So anyhow, that would be about the first week of August. And as I say, we took off and did the whole of the length of Italy and into Germany and Austria. We parted ways at the border.
But you and your mother parted at the border?
Yes, because she went to Munich, because she did Germany. And I went to the White Horse Inn, because I did Austria. And we stayed about a week, I suppose. Maybe not quite as long. Then we went back to Venice, where I received a letter from my future mother-in-law, which nearly made me not go. I nearly decided against marrying him. She wrote me a letter, and it didn't say, you'll be welcome, and I'm looking forward to seeing you, or anything like that, nothing at all. She gave me a long list of the way I had to behave in the little township in order to conform with the proper manners of the time.
In Brittany?
In Brittany. I had to wear gloves and I had to have a hat and I had to do this and I had to do that. I must behave so and so. It was an extraordinary letter. I don't know if I still got it. And not one word of affection or anything like that at all. She was a very straight-laced lady. However, I decided to go after all, and off I went.
So you travelled by train from Venice
up to Brittany.
To Brittany, with or without your mother?
Without. She went back to Ravello. She went back to Ravello to pack up. No, she didn't pack up then. She didn't pack up until February 1940. Because she came to stay with us in Egypt after I was married. And she stayed till February. And she still had the villa and all her things in it. And my father was hooting louder than ever. You must come back, you simply must come back, because there's no other way you're going to get through France, which was true after all. So in February she packed up and went to Ravello, packed up in Ravello and took everything, left a lot of things in Paris, which she never got back because they stole them. And she went back through Paris and managed to get back to London before Italy entered the war. She was just in time. So we were three times in town.
But meanwhile, you travelled to Brittany in August of...
I travelled to Brittany in August. And...
met your in-laws, future in-laws.
I met my mother-in-law. That was the only one. And I met some of the aristocracy of Brittany. Very strange lot they were, too.
In what way?
Well, they were living about 100 years ago. We went to have lunch with one pair who were very high class indeed. And we had lunch at a 15-foot table, highly polished. And we just sat in the middle with me and he on one side and my husband and she on the other, in the middle of this enormous expanse of table, decorated all down the middle with the family silver. It was quite a sign. And we visited several of the aristocratic acquaintance of my mother-in-law. And then, of course, things got really fierce. And they said war would break out any moment. So Louis was recalled to Egypt, and I decided to go to London to get my trousseau.
So Louis was with you when you went?
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.